University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, where he is also a professor of history since 1999. He has also taught at Georgetown University, Tulane University, Johns Hopkins University, and the University of Dallas, and is a senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. He's also a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, a senior fellow of the Trinity Forum, and a member of the Society of Scholars at the James Madison Program of Princeton University. Since 2002, he has served as a member of the National Council on the Humanities, the Advisory Board for the National Endowment for the Humanities, and is vice chairman of a newly created Jack Miller Center for the Teaching of America's Founding Principles. He is the author of many fine books, including The Masterless, Self and Society in Modern America, The Student's Guide to U.S. History, Religion Returns to the Public Square, Faith and Policy in Modern America, Figures in the Carpet, Finding the Human Person in the American Past, and he is currently working on a collection of essays entitled The Burden of the Humanities. He's also at work on a biographical study of the American sociologist David Reisman and is editing a collection of his own essays entitled Pieces of a Dream, Historical and Critical Essays. Dr. McClay was a Fulbright senior lecturer in American Studies during the spring of 2007 at the University of Rome, and he has been the recipient of several fellowships, including some from the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Academy of Education, the Howard Foundation, the Earhart Foundation, the Danforth Foundation. He was the co-editor of Rowan and Littlefield's book series entitled American Intellectual Culture, and he has served on several editorial boards for such periodicals as First Things, the Wilson Quarterly, the Public Interest Society, American Quarterly, and Touchstone. And he is a frequent contributor to a wide variety of both scholarly and general interest publications. And let me just also add on a personal note, he is a delightful conversationalist. Today, he will be speaking to us on the topic of does the idea of progress have a future, and offering three Christian perspectives. Will you please join me in welcoming Dr. Wilfred McClay?
Well, good, afternoon. And I'm delighted to be here. I've been curious about this institution for a long time, heard wonderful things about it, and now I discover they're all true, and then some. So thanks so much for having me, and thanks for turning out. I understand this is your first day back for classes, and you could have, this would be a great day to hibernate, but you've turned out, and I thank you for that. This is a talk that I've actually given as a paper, a version of this, for a secular audience of historians, and it's surprisingly adaptable to this setting, too. In a sense, what I'm looking at is the idea of progress and how it might be rescued. from the standpoint of Christian faith, you could say that in this context, it's really a kind of integration with faith with learning sort of question that I'm addressing. In these other settings, it's really the integration of learning with faith in a way. So I'm trying to make plausible to secular historians why some of the things that they presume in the activity that they undertake have their roots in the Western biblical religious tradition. So it's an interesting how adaptable it is to both settings. At any rate, my premise, my starting point, is with this notion of the idea of progress and the fact that we've become uneasy with the word and the concept of progress. We're not, of course, prepared to to give it up entirely, I think that would be inconceivable. And we in the West are still committed to the idea of purposive action in the world. We're resistant to the lure of fatalism. In fact, resistance to necessity is arguably one of the core instincts of the Western identity. But even our occasional attempts to sound fatalistic in our discourse betray all the things that that speech silently presumes, that we can't help projecting goals, even if short-range or proximate ones. And I think this is especially true in the United States, where even Jeremiads and Lamentations have a way of turning into exhortations, which are, of course, the opposite of fatalism. The language of true fatalism would be silence, but that's not what we're hearing. We're hearing, yes, we can. Hardly a fatalistic, it may have its problems, but as fatalism, it certainly is not. But there's no denying the fact that the idea of progress, with a capital P, so to speak, the liberating song of the Enlightenment, the marching music of the rise of the modern West, has become problematic to us. And this is a skepticism that runs deep. Not only is it our faith in the inevitability of progress that we question, but the very idea that we would have any sure means of judging what progress is, if indeed it does occur. Some of this is intellectual fashion, which comes and goes, and is a whole other subject. But a lot of it has to do with historical reality. The idea of progress, I would argue, received its most profound and enduring shock in response to the First World War. That conflict, an unprecedented, cataclysmic scale of destruction, which arose for obscure reasons, as historians are still puzzling over today, and then was carried along, seemingly unstoppably, by its own horrifying momentum. And it gave the lie to the notion that that the growth of knowledge and social organization and human control over the forces of nature would necessarily lead to harmony, prosperity, rationality, well-being. So ever since the Great War, the idea of progress has been on shaky ground. And of course, in the years since the Great War, which some people would say was not so great compared to the great that came after it, there's been plenty of evidence continuing to support this rather dismal view, running through the Second World War, through the collapse of the European colonial empires, the crises relating to natural resources and the limits of growth on the planet, the inequalities of wealth and poverty, all of these problems that bear in on us. And some see particularly profound civilizational demoralization in the specter of what's sometimes called demographic winter in the West. That is the starkly declining birth rates in country after country in the developed West, where birth rates are well below replacement levels, even in countries like Italy and Poland, you know, Catholic countries, they suffer from these very low birth rates. So all of these things add up to a perception that perhaps progress all along has been accompanied by a kind of shadow side that undoes all of the good that it seems on the surface to be emanating from what we call progress. This, I think, is too glib, but it is plausible, in my view, to say that what we call progress in history has not brought moral progress along with material progress. It's plausible to assert that what progress we have made in freeing humankind from material necessity, has also increased the possibilities for human transgressiveness and wanton cruelty, and has estranged us further from nature, and perhaps inhibited the development of more resilient, more capable individuals who are capable of sustaining love and empathy and self-giving. Maybe this last statement goes too far, but at any rate, one can say that the expansion of human agency, of the growing ability to master the material terms of our existence, has been an ambivalent achievement, one that does not necessarily bring moral improvement or human happiness. Those of you who were with me last night will recognize a certain parallelism to the themes I talked about last night. It won't stay there. I'm not going to say the same thing. But it's my conviction on the subject of this idea of progress that we do believe in it. It is almost encoded in our cultural makeup. We need to be able to believe in it more fully and confidently and unapologetically than we do now. We need it in order to continue to do the things that we do that need to be what we are, to sustain the things that we cherish, and exercise our moral freedom in the profoundest ways available to us. And at the peak of those, I would say the ability to give of ourselves for the well-being of others, including the careful and generous stewardship of the world's resources, with a view to the generations to come. But we need to find better ways of talking about progress and thinking about it, ways of chastening it, restraining it, and protecting it against its excesses. This theme of the idea of progress was the underlying theme of a grand and gloomy book published at the end of the gloomy, not so grand and gloomy 1970s by the sociologist Robert Nisbet, entitled The History of the Idea of Progress. It's a lot I could say about the book, but for our purposes, the thing I want to stress is that Nisbet, who is not a believer in any conventional sense, was not a believer, he's now dead, strongly connected the health of the idea of progress with the health of the Western religious tradition, meaning Judaism and Christianity. And I quote, "Any answer," Nisbet wrote, "to the question of the future of the idea of progress in the West is going to require an answer to a prior question. What is the future of Judaism and Christianity in the West?" He said it was a prior belief in the dimension of the sacred in human existence that gave authority to ideas of time, of history, of development, and either progress or regress. Only on the basis of such confidence in the existence of a divine patterning could the West come to be confident that there was such intelligible patterning in the history of the world. As I say, Nisbet was not himself a conventional believer. And there are other important secular figures who come to similar conclusions. For example, the German philosopher Jürgen Habermas, who is certainly a kind of icon of secularism. But biotechnology issues, particularly cloning, rattled his cage, his secularist cage. And he began conducting a dialogue with then Cardinal Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict, about these issues, and came to the conclusion, I won't read you the whole passage, which is in his inimitably turgid language, which sounds like, even in English, it sounds like German. So, but he concludes this saying that basically all of the things that we liberals in the West value about our Western civilization, its universalism, its egalitarianism, human rights, so on, that these are all, and I quote here, the direct legacy of the Judaic ethic of justice and the Christian ethic of love, that they wouldn't have come into being except as byproducts of those things. This is not quite the same thing as asserting the truth of a biblical religion, to be sure. But it's an argument for, at least culturally, the necessity of faith. So the question arises, the larger question, and this is really the question I'm addressing today, is does the perspective offered by the traditional biblical religious heritage of the West, what Nisbet called Judeo-Christianity, a term I really don't like, but is that the source, is that a way not only of originating the idea of progress, but a source for the critique of the excesses of the idea of progress? Is it a way of reining it in and renewing it at the same time? Can it give us the resources of better understanding that idea to have recourse to our religious heritage? So this is the point where, speaking to a secular audience, you know, people's backs start to stiffen and they say, oh no, here it comes. But thankfully, I don't sense your back stiffening any, so I'm going to plunge right ahead. But I'm going to talk about three historians, one of whom might be surprised to hear himself called a historian, but since he's dead, he's not here to contradict me. Herbert Butterfield, Christopher Dawson, and Reinhold Niebuhr, who I think all in different ways, in strikingly different ways, try to address this issue of the question of progress in history. They actually all three published books that were arguably their most important books that were in some fundamental way a response to the First World War attendant economic dislocations. And I won't lean too much on that part of the argument for today, but each one of them was fascinated by this notion of the idea of progress, saw it as being under challenge, and came to different conclusions about the future of the idea of progress. But all of them wanted to affirm it in ways that were grounded in their religious commitments, which would be brought in a fairly direct way on the subject at hand. In some sense, in other words, to boil this down, the relationship between the Christian cultural legacy and the idea of progress was the subject each of them was engaging. But they have three different answers, and that's really, the rest of my remarks are going to be devoted to kind of looking at the three different versions, and in some sense asking which one's the best or the most useful. Okay, first, Butterfield, a name you probably haven't heard. The historians here know Butterfield's name. He was a very eminent figure in British academic life in the early and middle parts of the 20th century. He taught for over 50 years at Cambridge University, where he held a variety of high titles. A scholar of remarkable range, wrote about the history of science, 18th century constitutional history, international politics, and such. But his book that I want to concentrate on, and I think it's the book he'll always be remembered for, is a book called The Whig Interpretation of History. That's W-H-I-G. Not that that clears up the mystery for any of you, but just so you aren't thinking of people with powdered wigs are running the show here. Without going into why he calls it Whig too much, which I'd have to sort of teach a mini course in British history to do that, but the point of Whig history is that Whig history is history that aligns the past with the present, that it sees the world is progressive, and the present is always an advance upon the past. I quote from him, Whig history refers to the tendency of many historians to write on the side of Protestants and Whigs, that is modernizers, just roughly speaking, to praise revolutions, provided they have been successful, to emphasize certain principles of progress in the past and produce a story which is the ratification and glorification of the present. Butterfield stood against these tendencies. They seemed to him oversimplifications, they seemed to him betrayals of the historian's real task, which was more modest. No, none of us, as mere mortals, have the sufficient knowledge to be making those kinds of final moral judgments about historical actors. Instead, Butterfield thought, historians should take losers just as seriously as winners. And instead of tracing a line of triumphant truths culminating in the dominant wisdom of the perfect and ever-perfecting present, it would seek to distance itself from this view and reject the self-satisfied idea that the way things turned out is, in some sense, the way they should have turned out. He says, in particular, the historian should not be the avenging judge, dispensing verdicts. He should try to, and I quote, enter into minds that are unlike our own, make sympathetic contact with the range of humanity, to see all lives as part of one web of life, and take men and their quarrels into a world in which everything is understood and all sins are forgiven, close quote. It's a kind of, that last part is hard to understand, so all sins are forgiven, but it's a kind of God's eye view that he's aspiring to, in which there's a deliberate attempt to set aside the dominant moral claims and sympathies of one's own era, not out of a misplaced relativism, emphatically not that, but out of a carefully thought out set of judgments about what the limits are of what historians can do and the virtues to which they can aspire. Now, this all reflects his faith. Butterfield was a very active Methodist, which is quite remarkable in that Cambridge setting, I assure you. Methodism was, you know, it would sort of be like being a Pentecostal in the Harvard faculty, I think, and it drew on this experience, his Methodism, in certain ways, certainly insisting on the equality of the historical experience of all persons and not merely the elites. All were equally creatures of God. All fell within his providential sway. All had intrinsic value. All would be judged by God alone, so that we should not presume to do so ourselves, even as historians. One might have guessed that his Christian convictions would have made him look for the traces of God's hand in history. Not the case at all. Butterfield was severe in denouncing the idea that historians could find the operations of providence in history. That was stepping over the line from being godly to being godlike. And that was the error committed by the Whig historians, who thought that they knew where history, with a capital H, was going. Butterfield thought this was arrogant and arrogation by the historian. That was not the historian's job. It was beyond his ken. So historians had to forswear any attempt to make moral claims about the deeds and consequences of human history. Providential understanding, like vengeance, should be yielded to the Lord, and for the same reasons. The best that the mortal historian can hope for is an impartial record with all of its complexities and ambivalences. History, he said, is not an oracle. The idea of progress, particularly as the Whig historians employed it, was a terrible simplifier in his view. It puffed ordinary men into profits and dispatched other men to the misfortune of being history's losers, i.e. oblivion. There's much to be said. I could say more about this, but you get the idea, I think. There's much to be said for it. There's much to be said for the generosity and modesty of the position. And actually, it corresponds very well with the general ethos of the historical profession, not all parts of it, and not always its practice. But this position, which I'm going to call the exclusionary position, I'm going to develop a typology of the three, doesn't really do justice to the problem, I think, completely. it leaves out of account one of the chief distinctives of, I'll use the term, Judeo-Christianity. That is, an understanding of divine history and human history as intersecting stories, and not merely parallel or disparate ones. It would be wonderfully simplifying if one didn't have to take account of this complexity. And of course, secular historians don't. But the Bible presents us with a God who takes a very strong and active interest in the doings of nations and the outcomes of historical events, and occasionally intervenes in them, sometimes quite dramatically. This God is also a God that delights in reversals and overturnings, making the first last and the last first, in ways that often subvert the world's paradigms. But he does not always do so, or invariably do so. Sometimes he does the opposite. Hence, although Christians can have no expectation that there will be a sure correspondence between worldly success and metaphysical success, if I could put it that way, they also can't expect that the two will always be at odds either. So, what to do with this unpredictable providence? What Butterfield did was something rather similar, and this we were talking about analytic philosophy, to what the analytical philosophers of his day were doing, asserting that because nothing definite can be said about God's activities in history, nothing should be said at all. Well, this is a move that makes sense on one level, but it introduces the inevitable intersection of the two in a Christian understanding of history. Here's another quotation from his book. He wrote a book called Christianity and History, which actually I've not referred to very much here, but it puts forward a lot of this. And he says, this is a kind of credo here. He says, I have nothing to say at the finish except that if one wants a permanent rock in life and goes deep enough for it, it's difficult for historical events to shake it. There are times when we can never meet the future with sufficient elasticity of mind, especially if we're locked in contemporary systems of thought. We can do worse than to remember a principle which both gives us a firm rock, capital R, and leaves us the maximum elasticity for our minds. The principle is this: hold to Christ, and for the rest be totally uncommitted. In other words, in place of progress with a capital P, we have the rock with a capital R, which is perhaps another way of saying that the ultimate truth is finally outside the reach of historical inquiry. Okay, so as I've said, I think there's a great deal to be said for this formulation, particularly as I just said it now, but it does not help us, does it, to address the problem with which I began, that is, whether there's a way that the religious tradition can be brought in to revitalize or reconfigure our sense of the troubled idea of progress in history. It doesn't just problematize the relation, it rules the inquiry out of bounds. Okay, are we doing on time? All right. Second, Christopher Dawson. Christopher Dawson, a very different view. He's an Oxford-educated independent scholar who converted to Roman Catholicism as a young man in his 20s. And in the England of his day, that meant that he would never have a regular academic appointment. But he did achieve quite a visibility in the intellectual world. He gave the Gifford Lectures, which have always been a kind of important signpost of theological achievement. And his book, Religion and the Rise of Western Culture, a very important book, came out of the Gifford Lectures. And he eventually had an appointment at Harvard and was influential with T.S. Eliot and so on. So he certainly was an important figure, just a bit of an outsider compared to Butterfield. The book of his that I want to consider is called Progress in Religion. It's explicitly a response to the First World War and to what he called the despair of the future of Europe. He agreed the idea of progress was imperiled and felt the full weight of that fact, but he attributed this to a wrong turn that modernity had made much earlier in believing that the idea of progress could be detached from its religious roots, and thus making the idea of progress itself into a kind of quasi-religion. That was the error that had to be reversed. Dawson went on to give a remarkably anthropological account of religion, that religion was the basis of every culture, that that the word culture came from the word cultus, you know, so that in fact, and of course there's considerable basis for this in at least some aspects of cultural anthropology. He was right in sync with the social scientists on that. And this outlook informed his understanding of the current crises of his day, including the diminution of the idea of progress. The West was for him the product of two things, the biblical tradition and the scientific tradition, which derived ultimately, he saw, from ancient Greece. He saw these as entirely complementary. He did not see faith and reason or science and theology as being in any kind of ultimate conflict. But he said that religion was really the dynamic force, not science, but religion, the organizing spark, the propulsive engine that gave energy and direction to the West. Hence, the religion of progress, an understanding of progress that had removed progress from its relationship to religion and established it as a secular force, was going to run out of gas eventually. It was going to lose vitality because it had lost its connection to the source and was doomed to fail. Progress had become a false object of worship that had been rendered false by being put into false relationship with the other parts of Western culture. So it's important to stress, there was no hostility to science in Dawson. He was a great fan of science. In fact, rather uncritically, saw science as, at worst, an entirely neutral force. But he worried about what science, in the absence of the restraint and grounding in religion, would eventually do. So he was actually quite enthusiastic about progress. In fact, there are times when he almost seems giddy about it, with a kind of high optimism about the ultimate resolution of all woes and the reaching of a kind of omega point within history, within secular history, that's startling to read, the degree of this sort of optimism. He was an early exponent of a united Europe, and certainly, you know, the debates over whether the EU constitution, which is now sort of floundering around, but whether it should include any reference to Christianity, which ultimately it didn't, this would have been a no-brainer of the highest order for Christopher Dawson. He was convinced that only the Christian tradition could supply the foundation for the social unification of Europe. In fact, his vision of European Union was not political. It was not a theocratic state, but, quote, a spiritual community whose centripetal energy transcends the economic and political orders. Very, very, as I say, utopian stuff. The thrust of this, much more to be said about Dawson, too, fascinating figure, underappreciated in today's world, and underappreciated, I think, by Protestants for reasons I'll come to. But the thrust of his work could not have been more different than from Butterfield's. Whereas Butterfield stressed the inappropriateness of imposing ideas of progress on political and social events, Dawson insisted on the impossibility of understanding political and social events without reference to precisely such ideas. So Butterfield wanted to keep the eternal and the temporal separate. Dawson saw the West precisely as the part of the world in which those realms have been shown to intersect, and in which the possibility of the separation had been refuted. The Christian, said Dawson, and he alone can find a solution to the paradox of the inherence of eternity in time and the absolute in the finite, a solution which does not empty human life and the material world of their religious significance and value. This, too, I think, is a rich understanding, very different from Butterfield's, and rich even for the non-Christian historian. We might classify this as a foundational understanding of the relationship between religion and historical practice or progress. But there are, I think, things that one can say in criticism of it. For one thing, in talking to a secular audience, I think the fact that social organization had always begun in religion in the past was not terribly persuasive that it would always needed to be the case in the future. Secular modernity never claimed to be able to justify itself by pointing to its long line of historical antecedents. It claimed to justify itself by breaking with that long line of antecedents. So Dawson wasn't terribly persuasive to them. Also, I think for Christians, Catholic and Protestant alike, there is a whiff here of the idea that of trading in the social usefulness of religion rather than the truth, that religion is useful for providing cohesion. Anytime you resort to social scientific arguments, you run the risk of a kind of functionalism, that it is the function of religion rather than its intrinsic truth that motivates you. And there's no apologetics in Dawson. He simply is content to make the argument for the functional utility. So it's, and of course, even to talk about religion, arguably, is to see faith in a comparative context. It's to detach, it's to speak as the scribes, if I may quote our Lord on this. to argue for the resurrection of religion because it's the dynamic core of a civilization and all of that is to make an argument from utility, not from truth. So it's possible that if the exclusionary stance of Butterfield claims too little, the foundational stance claims too much and insists on too close a connection, which ultimately for Dawson is a reconnection of Christianity with the historical church, which of course means with Roman Catholicism. Inevitably, Protestantism was for him a cause and symptom of the secularism of the moment. So that's another barrier. Trying to zip ahead here so we don't run out of time. Okay, finally, the third perspective. And this comes from Reinhold Niebuhr, the American theologian, probably the most prominent public theologian of the 20th century, a person who addressed an enormous number of subjects, a bit out of fashion at the moment, but he'll come back. Daryl Charles and I will see to it. And the book in particular, there's really a couple of books that I'm thinking of, but the one that in particular ties in with the others is his book Moral Man and Immoral Society, published in 1932, which also was in some ways a response to the First World War. And more generally to the fallacy, as he saw it, of progressivism's, I think it's the ideological expression of the idea of progress, with a capital P, progressivism's belief that human nature was malleable and perfectible. This was a characteristic that he saw in the social gospel movement, which he was exposed as a student at Yale. And ultimately, after embracing it for a period of time, he rejected it because of its naivete about the way that people actually behave, the fallenness of human nature, the manifestly non-perfectible qualities of the human heart and human soul and spirit. The social gospelers thought sin was just an expression of bad social relations, something that could be corrected with enlightened social engineering. Niebuhr, although he was a theological liberal, so it's not clear exactly ontologically what he meant by this, but he embraced the doctrine of original sin as empirically valid because it reflected the observable truth about human behavior as it actually was, and did so far better than the alternatives on offer. It required an enormous leap of faith to believe that men are perfectible, while it required only opening one's eyes to see that they're perverse. So Niebuhr dismissed the progressive hope that the sources of individual sin could be overcome through social reform, and America could eventually be transformed into a fellowship of like-minded comrades holding hands beside the national campfire. No, we can't. These harsh facts, however, did not mean that Niebuhr gave up on the possibility of social reform. No, Christians were obliged to work for reform. They were obliged to work for social justice and social ideals. Fatalism and complacency were not allowed. But to do this, they had to abandon the illusions that the social gospel and progressivism had burdened them with. Not least in the way they thought about themselves and about others. Niebuhr insisted that man is a sinner in his deepest nature, but man is also a splendidly endowed creature, made in God's image, capable of acts of wisdom and generosity and truth, and capable of advancing the cause of social improvement. All of these things were true at once, the good, the bad, and the ugly. All had a claim on the Christian mind and heart. This is part of the challenge of Niebuhr, is in his insistence that all of these things be held together in tension at once. He really addressed himself more directly to the idea of progress in his own Gifford Lectures, 1939, which is later published as a book called The Nature and Destiny of Man. Also a book that deserves a lot more attention than it gets. It's a huge two-volume work that really looks at the whole Western tradition. But I want to look at just this aspect relating to progress, in which he formulates what I'm calling the reflexive stance. So we have the three, exclusionary and now reflexive, exclusionary, foundational, and now reflexive, sorry. As Niebuhr saw it, the Christian worldview had always understood history to be meaningful. But the meaning is sometimes discovered outside the cross currents of history. Which made the interpretation of history very dicey. The secularized idea of progress, however, had a belief in what he called an immanent logos, which was no longer transcendent, being immanent, but was thought of as operating in history, bringing disorder gradually under the influence of reason and order, making, as he put it, chaos into cosmos. Like Dawson, he understood this as something that originated with Christian theology. But it had been altered, corrupted, by two crucial post-Christian developments in the Renaissance. First, this understanding of progress assumed that the fulfillment of life could occur without the intervention of grace, and the laws of reason and nature would be surrogates for providence, giving meaning to all of history. That, I think, is a fallacy that both of the others that we've talked about have dealt with. But here's the second part, and this is really where Niebuhr's distinctive comes in. The thinkers of the Renaissance, in his view, saw history rightly as dynamic, but they failed to see that the dynamism of history was twofold in character, double-edged, as I would say. It assumed that, and I quote Niebuhr here, all development means the advancement of the good. But in so assuming, it failed to recognize that, and again I quote, every heightened potency of human existence may also represent a possibility of evil. Every heightened potency of human existence may also represent a possibility of evil. Even a great progressive advance may contain within itself the potential for bringing about a calamity. And as Niebuhr explained it, everything that has its being within history is involved in contradiction to the eternal. This contradiction reflects the inevitable tendency of every comprehensive understanding of the meaning of history to complete this system falsely because of our human limitations. All modern interpretations of history, Niebuhr thought, have this tendency, this false completion. And here he sounds like Butterfield, and I quote, "They identify their own age or culture or even their own philosophy with the final fulfillment of life and truth in history. This is the very error which they've not taken into account in the basic principle of interpretation." And he goes on to say that this is something that no philosophy can escape from completely, but you can at least have a philosophy that understands that the error will be committed, and that it's like all of the other presumptions of history that defy the majesty of God. Okay, let me unpack this or boil it down a little bit. For Niebuhr, modern interpretations of historical progress have been right to see history dynamically, developmentally, and taking a broader view of history's possibilities. But they've conceived the dynamic too simply. I quote, "They hope for an ever-increasing dominance of form and order and refuse to acknowledge that history cannot move forward towards increasing cosmos, that is, order, without developing possibilities of chaos by the very potencies which have enhanced cosmos." You follow that? Okay. In other words, my way of putting it, we're never out of the woods. And in fact, the we go deeper into the woods the more we progress. A man's capacity for evil advances apace with his progress toward the good. Hence, the greater the progress, the greater the need for vigilance, the greater the need for some metaphysical check on human pride. There was no better example, Niebuhr thought, of this dual aspect of history than the United States, where so many manifest strengths could also become dangerous weaknesses. And I will skip over his discussion of that, but he wrote a book called The Irony of American History, which is a beautiful explication of that. So Niebuhr, again, took the doctrine of original sin, which he believed to be the core of the Christian understanding of human nature, as central to American democracy. It's the best guarantor of the possibility of the marginal improvement of the human race, which is progress rightly understood, since it gives us a truthful and realistic picture of what actually is a very crooked timber of humanity and prepares us to live with this disjunction. Okay. Brief summary, and then we're done. Okay, of the three writers under consideration here, I suspect that Niebuhr may be the one with the most to offer us, at least in immediate terms, in thinking about how a religious perspective might offer us some enlightenment on the present condition and prospects of progress. This reflexive outlook takes account of the virtues of both Dawson's and Butterfield's works, but also insists that the misuses of the idea, including this overconfident identification of man's purposes with God's, are paradigmatic examples of sin at work, and insisting that the dynamic of progress in history is by its very nature full of moral peril to us, precisely because we're the kinds of beings that we are. What original sin is to the individual, this duality of history's dynamic is for the idea of progress. The second is merely the amplification of the first. What the 19th century lacked that we now have in spades is a sense of the perilousness of progress. We have progressed that far. to that level of self-understanding. But now we risk being overwhelmed by the sense of peril. Having discovered that progress is not a god, we are now inclined to deny its existence entirely. This seems unwise. For we do still believe in progress in some form. What we need is a chastened but strengthened understanding of the idea and the possibilities of genuine human altruism that has the capacity to hold together a strong sense of both the promise and the peril that our efforts in the world entail. Progress in history has turned from a complacent march into a tense tightrope walk. We can see now that every step we take not only carries us further along, which makes us pleased and optimistic, celebratory, but it also makes a possible fall more calamitous, which makes us terrified. We cannot afford to stop. Any of you who've ever been on a tightrope know that you can't stop. But we also cannot afford to fall. So we must be very careful where we step, how we step, and must consider where we are going. To do so, it would help greatly to have a clearer and more realistic sense of what kind of strange and willful, but also noble and imaginative creatures we humans are. Any idea of progress, secular or religious, that does not do both of these things will be of little help to us. Thank you all very much for what was, I think, a fairly long talk. I appreciate your attention. And I think we have a little bit of time if anybody wants to comment or ask questions or give a speech, whatever you'd like. Play the piano. Yes. I agree, and that in fact, I mean, I'm a bit Whiggish when it comes to Protestantism. I take the Protestant side myself, but although I think we're at an interesting juncture now with regard to the kind of rapprochement between Protestants and Catholics, but that's a whole other subject. One thing I just have to get out first is that that's a great, interesting question. But there's a difference, it seems to me, between talking about the conditions of progress as a more general consideration and talking about the conditions that facilitate the rise of exceptional individuals, which is, I think, what Murray was writing about. I mean, he's really interested in the question of genius, right? Of people who are, those are different questions. They may ultimately relate to the same thing, but I think, for example, I can't go for more than 24 hours without quoting Tocqueville. So it hasn't quite been 24 since the last time, but. But you know, Tocqueville's view of America was that, in fact, what was happening in America in the 19th century was that you were achieving a kind of high mean, a civilization that was mediocre in a sense, a non-pejorative sense, if that's possible, where the mean was much higher than the mean of all but the elite in Europe, but at the same time, Tocqueville predicted that Americans would not excel in the arts, would not, so on and so forth, because of the fact that those things required the structure of an aristocratic society, but in the way he meant an aristocratic society. I think the jury's still out on that, actually. I mean, I think that it may well be, and I'm as red-blooded a patriot as the next person, but it may be that our cultural achievements in literature and so on are not quite on the same scale with our political achievements. But and the great cultural achievements of America are in the area of mass entertainment. You know, popular music. Well, popular music, Disney, who actually was a bloody genius in his own way, in his own world, in his own métier. But you see where I'm going with this, and I'm not sure whether the conditions that make for the greatest good for the greatest number are the same as the conditions that make for genius. And you could, but although in this case they seem to coincide, I think that Protestantism, and again, we're just looking at this externally, right? We're not talking about issues of truth, at least not overtly, but that Protestantism does empower the individual, does make the individual more of an agent, more of a responsible party. It stimulates initiative and activity because of the sense that one has a personal and unmediated relationship to the ultimate source of being. That's a very powerful thing, as opposed to that relationship being mediated by some institutional or priestly mediator. So I can see how in both in the ways in which it empowers individual sort of people who are geniuses to creativity, but also in building, as let's say the Methodists did in 18th century England, you know, taking a industrializing England that was just full of all kinds of horrific social problems and bringing a kind of social discipline that probably would have come from no other source, that created a much more stable British civilization. And there are comparable things that evangelicalism did here. That's also true. I just think there's somewhat different effects, although maybe emanating from the same cause. That other questions? Yes. Uh-oh. Well, it just so happens. Yeah, no, I've been thinking about this. Newhouse told his intimates before he died that there were two things in his work that he wanted to see carried on. And one of them was the magazine, First Things. The other one was, as he called it, ECT, Evangelicals and Catholics Together. That was his hope and intention. This actually relates to the gentleman's question more the more I think about it, because I don't know that without Richard Newhouse ECT would have happened, and I don't know whether without him it will continue. It may be a case where the particular outlook and life experience and skills, immense interpersonal skills, shall we say, of this man, who also was extraordinarily connected in the Jewish community and respected. He just had a knack for this kind of thing, for having sort of interfaith and interconfessional relations without compromising, and without sort of turning everything to vanilla of pudding. Someone else will have, I mean, it's the kind of thing that needs a leader. You know, you have a pope who was actually participated in the fringes of this when he was still a cardinal. That's very promising. I think on the Protestant side, the main line has just gone crazy, and which is part of the reason why there is ECT. Evangelical world, I think, is in some turmoil. It always is, of course, but what else is new? But I think some of the leaders, Chuck Colson, of course, was the key evangelical figure in that. He doesn't have the kind of sway, the kind of clout that he had, and I think that's. And if you look at the people who are kind of coming along, Rick Warren is, it's not really clear. He's more of Billy Graham than he is Chuck Colson. But in any event, Newhouse, for some reason, never sought out Rick Warren, which sort of surprised me. I actually suggested it to him, and he didn't seem to have any interest. The emergent church, there's no interest in that. Great suspicion of it, in fact, I think rightly so. It's not clear where evangelical leadership is going to come from to sort of meet on the other side of that. So I think it's one of those things that it's now at a point where if this is something that's meant to be a historical movement, the right people are going to have to arise somehow, and will arise if the movement is ineluctable. I think a lot of that's going to depend on. It's also going to depend on political issues. I mean, the issue of abortion, for example, is kind of in abeyance now. I mean, with the new administration, and now it may flare up. That certainly was the thing that kind of triggered the bonding of the two groups. But ECT was much bigger than that. And of course, as I don't need to tell you, the a lot of people on both sides didn't like it. There are definitely both Catholics who didn't like it and even, there's sort of R.C. Sproul on one side and any number of Catholics on the other who wished the project ill. So it was an embattled movement even at its best. It's certainly something I wish it well. I think it's proceeded more or less responsibly in trying to sort of clarify what the differences are, because there are differences that I think can never be and should not be erased. But at least there can be greater clarity about what the differences are and not confusion about them, because, of course, what Catholics think about Protestants and what Protestants think about what they think about one another is often fraught with all kinds of illusions and exaggerations. There are enough real differences alone to keep the differences alive, but it would be much healthier to clarify those differences. So, you've tapped on something that's been on my mind a lot lately, and I don't know the answer, but I hope it survives. And it certainly was Newhouse's, practically dying breath that these were the two things that he wanted to see carried on. One more question. You mean in contemporary American society? Oh, look, I think this is not going to strike you as a kind of newsflash from the beyond or anything, but I actually think the election of Obama is a great sign of progress. I didn't vote for him myself. I wouldn't vote for him now. I don't think I'll vote for him 4 years from now. But there is definitely for any person of goodwill who has felt burdened by the racial tensions and discords and inequities of our society. It's a tremendous breakthrough, a tremendous moment. I don't dispute for a moment that it's been ballyhooed to death, and that there may be less ways in which it's a kind of therapy for the country that it's actually going to pay a serious price for. But I think on balance, it certainly is a sign of a long arc of progress on matters of race that we should be grateful for. And that's no small thing. As you and I both are old enough to remember when things were very different. These young people here just all take it all for granted. But in fact, I often feel that, you know, Henry Kissinger once said that he'd ask, I don't know that I believe this ever really happened, because it's Henry Kissinger, but it just is too neat. But he asked Zhou Enlai what he thought about the French Revolution. And Zhou Enlai reportedly said, "It's too early to tell." So, as part of me is tempted to answer your question that way, but the Obama thing is ambivalent as I feel about him myself. I feel no ambivalence about the sense that there is some kind of an arrival there for all of us. That may actually, a lot of times by the time social problems are actually solved, and I'm not saying this solved anything, but they've become trivial, so that in fact for many people this may seem a kind of, well, big deal. We elected a non-white president, you know, a mixed race man, this president, big deal. But I think it is. I think it is a big deal. And I think you have to take the longer view there. In terms of the moral renewal of the country, there I'm less sanguine. But I'm just going to stop while I'm ahead. I have one index of progress that I'm willing to acknowledge.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks to you all for turning out. Appreciate it.
For those of you who are still here, please do take some food on the way out. It's in the hallway right at the back of this. There's a table out there. Take some with you. Enjoy. Thank you for coming.